Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, June 3rd, 2015. Senior members of the South Sudan ruling party meet in Juba with former political detainees to find a lasting solution to the South Sudan conflict.
We have reached a tipping point, I would say, towards peace. And you heard our president and chairman of the SPLM, he said he gave his commitment, all the leadership that was present, gave their support to him and have authorized him to take any decision necessary that will achieve peace.
And a new report indicates Sudan is arming the SPLM in opposition despite denials from Khartoum and the rebels.
The equipment was airdropped. Most of the equipment was somehow deformed or bent, probably due to the impact at the moment of the landing.
We'll have these stories and more coming up shortly. President Salva Kiir and high-ranking members of South Sudan's ruling party have agreed to join forces with former political detainees and work to end nearly 18 months of conflict in the country. Now the two sides want to bring former Vice President Riek Machar's faction of the SPLM into the deal to end the fighting and reunify SPLM. Philip Thonaleu reports for VOA from Juba.
The former detainees are in Juba for talks on reunifying the SPLM and reviving the long-running but so far ineffective peace talks led by regional bloc IGAD. John Lukjok, the former Minister of Justice and acting spokesman for the former political detainees, says the two sides at yesterday's talk agreed to work simultaneously to achieve both goals.
The complementarity of the two processes was emphasized, and there was full agreement that both processes have one objective, one and the same objective, which is achieving peace in South Sudan. Because even the unity of the SPLM without achieving peace would not deliver much.
Luke says that at the meeting, which ran late into the night yesterday, leaders of both factions of the SPLM accepted responsibility for the conflict.
The problems that the country faces today are problems that originated from within the SPLM leadership. So we carry a lot of burden, a lot of responsibility as leaders of the SPLM to see that the solution must also start from us. We feel ashamed, really, if we see our people, what is happening to our people today, the suffering that our people are facing today, we cannot live with it as leaders. It's a bad mark on us as leaders, and we take collective responsibility for all this that is happening to our people today.
He says everyone at the meeting agreed that the fighting needs to end.
We have reached a tipping point, I would say, towards peace. And you heard our president and chairman of the SPLM, he said he gave his commitment, all the leadership that was present, gave their support to him and have authorized him to take any decision necessary that will achieve peace.
The former detainees said in a statement that they now plan to meet with former Vice President Riek Machar and other leaders of the SPLM in opposition. Machar upshot of the SPLM, which is splitted into different factions at the start of the fighting in December 2013, has not taken part in the latest talks to reunify South Sudan ruling party. Luke says the former political detainees plan to meet Machar before an IGAD-led meeting in Addis Ababa, which is supposed to start on Sunday. Luke says South African and Tanzanian officials who have been mediating the efforts to reunify the SPLM will also meet Machar, although he did not specify when. Anne Eto, the acting Secretary General of the SPLM, says yesterday's marathon meeting between the former detainees and the ruling SPLM is proof that both sides are determined to rebuild the party in the 18 months of conflict. Eto says she hopes the success of the talks between the ruling SPLM and the former detainees will encourage Machar faction to be part of the effort.
We also hope that this unity, this coming together, would also encourage them to put the people of South Sudan first and join hands with the SPLM in Juba and SPLM former detainees, so that together we become strong, put what has happened behind, and work for peace in the interest of our people.
Luke says the PAI former detainees will return to Nairobi today and report to their colleagues and President Uhuru Kenyatta, who last week announced a new peace initiative for South Sudan. It was under the Kenyan president's initiative that the former detainees went back to Juba for talks with Mr. Kiir and the leaders of the ruling SPLM. The former detainees' visit to South Sudan is their first since they were, quote, forced into exile, unquote, after being detained by the South Sudanese authorities in December 2013 and accused of plotting to oust Mr. Kiir. For BOA News, I am Philip Thonaleu in Juba.
As talks continue about combining forces to end the long conflict, a British-based research group says it has evidence indicating that Sudan has supplied weapons to Machar's rebel group. The Conflict Armament Research Group says in a report released that its investigators analyzed ammunition and guns used by rebels in Jonglei and Unity states. Charlton Doki has this report for VOA from Juba.
Claudio Gramizi, the lead investigator at Conflict Armament Research, says the ammunition and weapons were airdropped by Sudanese planes to rebel fighters in Upper Nile and Jonglei states on several occasions from September to December of last year.
I think we can fairly surely confirm the fact that this equipment was airdropped. This comes not only from the reports of the SPLA officers that worked with us, but also from the fact that most of the equipment was somehow deformed or bent, probably due to the impact at the moment of the landing.
Gramizi says the ammunition his group analyzed appears to have been manufactured in Sudan. He says the head stamp codes and marking codes on the ammunition were identical with Sudanese manufactured ammunition analyzed earlier.
This is quite interesting, not only because they are Sudanese manufactured, which by itself may not be a big indication of the chain of custody and the origin of these equipment, but the fact that many of them were actually manufactured in 2014. So the same year they were used by the rebels, which to us is an indication of the fact that the chain of custody had to be very short and therefore probably suggesting a direct origin from Sudan.
Conflict Armament Research investigators also analyzed some rifles captured from rebels by government forces in Upper Nile and Jonglei states. Gramizi says a common type of gun analyzed is the Chinese-made Type 56-1 rifle, the Chinese version of the Russian-made Kalashnikov assault rifle.
One of them was quite interesting because it has a number of features that can be considered identical to those we could document on other weapons. We know they were supplied by Sudan to other groups that have been fighting against the Juba government before the crisis kicked off in 2013. What is even more interesting is that this weapon was bearing no serial number, meaning that the serial number had been scratched off, which is a fairly regular modus operandi for the Sudanese army.
Dickson Gatluak, a military spokesman for the SPLA in opposition, denies his group receives any support from Khartoum.
We have even been accusing by the Juba government, by the Juba regime, that we are getting support, military support from Khartoum. And this is, these are baseless. If you look at it, these are the unfounded stories. We are using the enemy as a source of our ammunition. We are not getting any support from Khartoum government.
Gatluak says the rebels get their arsenal and ammunition from defeated government forces or those who choose to join their side. The group says some of the ammunition it analyzed was manufactured in China in 2011 and 2012. And Gramizi says Chinese manufactured ammunition captured from the rebels in Jonglei state is identical to the ammunition used by rebels during what the UN labeled a massacre that occurred at a mosque in Bentiu in April of last year. Gramizi says his group did not determine the chain of custody or how the Chinese ammunition was supplied to the rebels, because they were unable to discuss the matter with Chinese authorities. Therefore, he says, it's impossible to say whether that ammunition was exported directly to Sudan or if it came by way of third parties. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Meanwhile, at the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva, the United Nations Refugee Agency reports heavy fighting and lack of food in two South Sudanese states are forcing more people to flee their homes. The UNHCR says more than 100,000 people have been displaced during the past 2 months, adding to those already displaced inside the country. Lisa Schlein has the story for VOA from Geneva.
A surge of fighting between South Sudan's government and rebel forces has uprooted tens of thousands of people in Unity and Upper Nile states since the start of April. It also has forced aid organizations in the region to withdraw. As a consequence, the UN Refugee Agency reports 650,000 people have not received critical humanitarian aid. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says there was a sharp increase in the number of people fleeing to neighboring Sudan, Ethiopia, and Uganda in May. He says about 6,000 South Sudanese arrived last week in Sordan's White Nile and South Kordofan states. Refugees cite the increased fighting and lack of food as the main reasons for fleeing their homes. Edwards tells VOA, since South Sudan erupted in conflict in December 2013, there have been a number of major displacements.
We're in another tragic wave, which once again is having its greatest impact on civilians. There are pressures growing, of course, on surrounding states once again as this happens. We have 2 million people who are either internally displaced or refugees. You have almost 4 million people who are without sufficient food. So the pressures on the population, on civilians in South Sudan and surrounding countries cannot be overstated.
Also last month, the government of President Salva Kiir expelled the UN humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan, Toby Lanzer. The head of UN information in Geneva, Ahmed Fawzi, says the United Nations has not been informed about the reasons for this action.
The situation is quite dire, and that's why the Secretary General himself has condemned the government's decision to expel the deputy head of mission in South Sudan. His replacement has already been nominated last month, and he was about to end his term anyway. And his replacement had been nominated, and we hope he will be allowed to deploy.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon nominated Eugene Owusu of Ghana as Lanzer's successor on May 29th. Mr. Ban is urging South Sudan to cooperate fully with all UN agencies in the country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. People living with disabilities say South Sudan's conflict is making life especially difficult for them. We'll tell you why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you were president of your country, what is the first thing you would do?
If I became a president today, I would start up by overhauling the entire system, by reducing the public spending, and maybe bringing in the private. This is the entrepreneurship, the entrepreneurs. Those are the people who build up nations.
For my country, first to put term limits. Yeah, because I believe when there are term limits, there will be a change. Like, we could have someone who can see something, things from a different perspective and, you know, at the end of the day, bring change to the country in every aspect.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's decision to expel United Nations humanitarian coordinator Toby Lanzer this week is drawing fire from the United States. State Department spokesman John Kirby says in a statement that Lanzer's expulsion is, quote, an affront to the international community working to bring peace and stability to South Sudan, end quote. The United States praises Lancer for addressing their humanitarian situation in South Sudan, even as the government shows what the U.S. calls callous disregard for its own people. The State Department stresses that the United States strongly supports Lancer's work and the work of the UN mission in South Sudan and calls for the expulsion order to be revoked. Lancer is due to leave the country at the end of this month to take up a new post, but currently is not in South Sudan. Around 20 people took part today in the first of a series of workshops in Wau to learn how to deal with psychological wounds of conflict. The Roman Catholic Church, which organized the workshop, says psychological scars have to be dealt with before South Sudanese can achieve lasting reconciliation. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA News from the capital of Western Bahr el-Ghazal State.
Assunta Musama was one of seven women involved in today's workshop. She says that in her community, many individuals suffer from mystery illnesses that she thinks can be traced back to trauma. She says many people carry with them the psychological scars that come with losing their entire family, being raped, or witnessing atrocities during 18 months of conflict in South Sudan.
Trauma has very many costs. For instance, one of the factors is war or conflict, like what is happening in South Sudan right now. And due to sudden news, you are just maybe relaxing or you are there where you are. And then you get a telephone call, maybe that three of your family members have died or they are killed. So this is a sudden information whereby you get yourself traumatized within the shortest moment. You may even lose control of yourself. You will not know who you are by then and what to do next.
Musama says women and girls in South Sudan bear most of the scars of South Sudan's conflict because they are so vulnerable to attacks. She says there is no safety net for sufferers of psychological trauma and they are left to struggle with their own physical injuries and depression.
When you are raped, you feel isolated. That is trauma. You will just keep on thinking, I'm no longer useful. I'm useless. All sorts of negative thoughts will come to your mind and you'll find yourself shrinking, losing weight. Sometimes it gives you no appetite to eat. If you're a school girl, you'll end up not understanding anything in class or even when you're revising because your mind could just reflect back to the incident that has happened or has taken place in you. You will just be reflecting. For instance, if it happens, that may be from the soldier. Whenever you see a uniform, you will just feel like this is the category of people. You will end up hating them. You will not have that peace in you.
Father Justin Atit is facilitating the trauma workshop, a cleric in the Wau Roman Catholic Diocese. Atit believes reconciliation can begin before the conflict in South Sudan ends. But he says healers must focus on developing a positive attitude of coexistence, not on tribal differences.
There is so much revenge in the heart of our people. There is so much ethnicity, which is really something rampant, going around. People talk in terms of ethnic group. And with that, definitely there's no reconciliation. And so, meaning people are quite traumatized and they need to get in touch with their inner self. And to get in touch with your inner self, you need to also get in touch with your issues. And what are those issues? If it is the issue of revenge in my heart, you know, if I go and attack my brother, attack my sister in revenge, what goal am I achieving? I'm achieving nothing. I'm actually creating more problem because at the end of the day, there will be a vicious cycle of violence.
Atit says counseling and medication can help to ease psychological trauma. But he says people also have to openly talk about their fears and feelings.
Before we talk about reconciliation, forgiveness, why don't we address the wounds that is within, deep within our hearts? Because once these wounds are addressed by talking about them, because that is the only way. There is no medication that you're going to, you know, to be giving prescription for somebody to heal those wounds. Those wounds means what? Those wounds means we need to own up. If this is what I have in my heart, I need to express it. When you talk about something which is paining you and you tell others about it, you know, you are letting it out. You are ventilating it. And after this ventilation, then what gets in is the air. And that is exactly the healing process.
The Trauma Healing Project is funded by Dutch Mensen Metin Miche, which means people with a mission. Participants in the workshop were members of peace committees from parishes around Western Baal Gazal or Roman Catholic clerics who deal with trauma healing in their dioceses. They will be trained and ready to put what they have learned into practice in around 1 month. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio.
Fighting between the warring parties is affecting the work of many NGOs, including efforts to provide support for people living with disabilities. An NGO called Light for the World was forced to suspend trachoma mapping in South Sudan due to insecurity. Bor Hospital was totally destroyed, including an eye care wing that was established there. Despite the dangerous environment, one Nigerian woman continues to help people with disabilities in the country. Toyin Jane Aderemi, a wheelchair-bound program manager for Light for the World, tells VOA's Kim Louise why it's important to oversee rehabilitation services for hundreds of South Sudanese children and adults with disabilities.
People with disabilities are usually marginalized in any population. And in times of conflict and war and even natural disasters, we still see that even this situation of marginalization gets worse. And this is our reason for attending to the needs and the concerns of people with disabilities who are displaced in South Sudan right now.
What types of programs do you oversee for people with disabilities who are refugees?
Generally, we do what we call disability inclusion. We focus on interventions that can ensure that people with disabilities are also being reached by any type of services in those internally displaced people's camps. And that is what we do. And specifically, our interventions focus on what we call the community-based rehabilitation approach. We use that approach to ensure the inclusion of people with disabilities in those IDP camps. For example, we have our CBR worker, that is community-based rehabilitation workers. We have an expert who works in those camps. And what she does is that she identifies children and adults with disabilities in those camps. At the beginning, we identify them, then we assess them according to the type of their disabilities and the severity of those disabilities, as well as the type of interventions that we need. So then we go on to make sure that those interventions are in place. And one of such interventions is that we go to the houses or to the shelters in the camps, and we give rehabilitation to those that need it. We also provide assistive devices like wheelchairs, white canes to those that need it. And apart from that, after we see that children, for example, are stabilized, we link them to the schools that serve those IDP camps. There are also some of them, either adults or children, who need referrals to other services that are not available within the camp or that are not even available within the country. And to do this, we also collaborate with other international NGOs who work in the camp. We also have what we call inclusive sports for peace. And in this, we identify a group of youth in those camps and we gather them together. We formed 3 football clubs. And in these clubs, we also have youth with disabilities. And we engage them so that they get involved in sports. We also introduce an aspect of sexual reproductive health talk, peace talk.
Also, what types of challenges do you face in supporting people with disabilities in conflict regions, such as in South Sudan?
The greatest challenge that we have is access to funds, because donors don't see issues of disability as a priority in emergency situations, and which is not supposed to be, because conflict and war itself increase the number of people with disabilities. We have people who sustain injuries, people who get amputated, people who, as a result of the war and the conflict, get or acquire impairments. But what we see is that it's very difficult to access funds. Another challenge that we also face is that most of the mainstream NGOs that work in the camp, don't have any knowledge of how to make their services accessible to those with disabilities. It's a bit easier to address because we approach them and let them know what they could do. Most of them, when we approach them, they listen. Even when they listen, it still goes back to my first point. So I would say the main challenge is funds.
How does your own personal story fit into the work that you do?
I'm a woman with disability. I'm a polio survivor and I use a wheelchair. The fact that I have a disability is an advantage to me as a development worker. Because when I talk to people for interventions, they listen better because they know I also experience what it is. And also, I bring my experience on board during interventions. Like, for example, let's say we need to modify some structures in the camp. I'm able to say, okay, why don't we do this? It's better this way, it's better that way. So that experience also comes handy for me.
That's Toyin Jane Aderemi, a program manager for the NGO Light for the World. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Abadan, Nigeria. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir yesterday was sworn in for another five-year term, extending his 25-year rule. Mr. Bashir has survived civil wars, an international war crimes indictment, and sanctions. In his latest bid to remain in charge, Mr. Bashir has switched alliances and is now collaborating with Saudi Arabia after nearly two decades of strained ties with that country. Mr. Bashir won re-election in April, though opposition parties boycotted the vote. Amnesty International says Nigeria's military has killed thousands of people during its fight against the Boko Haram extremist group. Human rights group Amnesty International says Nigerian soldiers and militiamen have murdered, tortured, and abused thousands of detainees since March of 2011. An Amnesty report released today says detainees have been rounded up in mass sweeps in towns and cities in the country's northeast, taken to makeshift prisons where some died of thirst, hunger, and suffocation, or were poisoned by chemicals sprayed into their cells. And finally, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the military campaign to stop the Islamic State group has killed more than 10,000 of its fighters. His comments to France's Inter-Radio today comes a day after he and officials from other coalition partners met in Paris with Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to discuss their strategy to fight the Islamic State. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song We Want Peace by Emmanuel Jal.
And we gonna get it. Throw your hands in the air, let me see that you're with it. Corrupt governments causing wars and beef, and my only intent is to bring about peace. Sudan and Darfur gonna stand up proud, and the newborn mouths gonna shout it out loud. Freedom, freedom, song of the free one, fighting for the people in the African kingdom. Freedom fighters, we really need them. People in the world, you all gotta be one. The evil and the wicked we will destroy, bringing peace to every man. The massacre that happened in Africa, to all the greedy leaders, we're coming after you. We're gonna capture and take back our streets. Listen to the rhyme as I bring about peace.
We want peace, and we're gonna get it. We're gonna get it. We're gonna get it. We want peace, and we're gonna get it.
We have been listening to Emmanuel Jal with that song, We Want Peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for tuning us in. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.